Your Financial Choices may discuss various financial-related topics and thus would like to offer the following disclosures. Lori Siebert is employed by Valley National Group, the Valley National Financial Advisors Group of Companies. Investments are offered through Valley National Investments Incorporated, member FINRA. We inform you that any federal tax, state tax, financial advice, or information contained in this communication is not intended to be personalized or specific in nature or to be relied upon for your personal situation in any circumstance. The advice and information are not intended and cannot be used as a tax opinion letter nor used for the purpose of avoiding tax-related penalties. For personalized advice specific to your own situation, we recommend that you consult your CPA, CFP, or attorney.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. I am a CPA, CFP professional, and AEP on the web at yourfinancialchoices.com and online each and every week at wdiy.org, either streaming live or on the WDIY app. Podcasts of prior programs are also available at wdiy.org under Public Affairs. Today is March 23rd, 2022. The markets were down today with the Dow closing at 34,358, the NASDAQ at 13,922, and the S&P at 4,456. Our topic tonight, again, is listeners' tax questions. And I think this will probably be like the last chance on this one. We're closing up tax season, April 18th. We're getting close to the end. Most of you may have already filed your tax returns. There are a lot of last-minute people. So if you have questions, be a great time to call and ask to see if we can move or help you move your tax return forward. So again, listeners, tax questions again tonight, and I'll talk about some things to pay attention to as well. We will take your questions. Eric is in the studio with us this evening. We'll answer your calls, take your information, and we ask you to mute your radio so you can hear me without the delay and we can talk without confusion. We discuss general financial planning topics and not specific investments. And while I typically have a topic each week, you can still ask questions off topic, and I will do my best to answer them. The number is 610-658-8810. That's 610-758-8810. Email is also available at yourfinancialchoices.com. If you prefer not to speak live, you can certainly just give your question to Eric, and he'll write it down and bring it into the studio. Again, tonight's topic is listeners' tax questions. I did have someone email a question, Marcy, and she asked, I was fortunate to receive an inheritance in early 2021. I knew that I would owe income tax on the dividends, but was not aware of the underpayment penalty and interest that I would be assessed for not making estimated quarterly payments. First, what is the penalty? I understand there is a PA form, Rev 1630, which addresses this. And second, how do I make estimated quarterly payments going forward, considering a majority of the money is in mutual funds and fluctuate as the market goes? Any thoughts would be most appreciated. So in responding to Marcy, what I wanted to say is dividends, because there were some other nuances to the question, so I'm trying to edit as I speak here. What happens on your state return, it happens on your federal return as well. The IRS, Pennsylvania, they are pay-as-you-go systems, so these government entities want you to pay your taxes as you go along. Typically, when we work, we have wages and our employers withhold the tax. It may or may not be the equivalent of what our tax ends up being. That's why we have to file a tax return and calculate what it is, along with other things we have on our tax returns. And our withholdings from our work may cover it. Maybe we don't work. Maybe we take distributions from IRAs and we might have withholdings on those. Those might cover our taxes due. We might have withholdings on our Social Security. Those might cover our taxes due. But from time to time, there's a bit of a mismatch, especially when we have tax consequences for things on a tax return. So in Marcy's situation, she had inherited some money, which meant she had some new investments that she hadn't had in prior years. So now all of a sudden, she has interest or dividends or capital gain distributions from mutual funds that maybe she couldn't anticipate. She couldn't estimate what those were going to be. She files her tax return, and all of a sudden, she owes more money because of this new stuff. What happens? Well, if you just enter, all the information on your tax return and it shows that you have a balance due, there would be a penalty for underpayment, quite possibly, if you didn't pay in enough. So there could be an underpayment penalty or interest for the taxes that you didn't pay. There is a form you can fill out for both federal and for the state. For federal, it's called a Form 2210, and for the state, it's a 1630. And basically, it is a form to calculate the penalty on the underpayment of taxes. Typically, government entities give us what we call safe harbor rules. Safe harbor rules will say if you paid in at least as much as you owed in the prior year is a safe harbor. For higher net worth clients, then that's usually 110%, but basically it's 100% of the prior year. Second safe harbor is 90% of the current year. So you still would owe tax, but you might not owe penalty. This is for federal purposes, 90% of the current year. Or there's another method called the annualization method where you can say, but hey, I didn't have that income during the year. I didn't know I was going to have it. You know, we heard about one very large mutual fund company who had huge capital gains distributed from their target date funds to unsuspecting investors who may not have seen those in prior years. And all of a sudden, at the end of 2021, they were hit really big in December. We had a lot of clients who had some mutual funds that had some very large capital gains. The markets have done very, very well. Some of the money managers were taking those gains, and they come to investors quite often in the last month of the year, December. So you could be surprised. Well, that's when you could use the annualization method. So if your other income comes steadily through, like your wages, but then all of a sudden you had a huge capital gain in the last quarter of $40,000, you can put that into the form 2210 or 1630 for PA, and it will factor in that you wouldn't have owed taxes, remember, evenly throughout the year, because it was skewed toward the last quarter. So in some instances, you can lower the penalty that may be assessed by using the annualization method. But quite often, you can avoid those penalties by showing what you owed in the prior year. Why it might not trigger for someone is if you're switching softwares, if you self-prepare your return and you switch softwares, you might not automatically have the prior year's taxes and prior year's income in that software. So you want to make sure you enter it, and then it might just, make it poof, go away. Or if you paper file your returns, some people still do that, you might not think to go get one of those forms to calculate the underpayment penalties, and you would want to go through those calculations of putting in the prior year's amounts and following the instructions. The forms are actually a little complicated, if you ask me. It's wonderful to have software that does that. So then going forward, if in this current year you find out you owed more and you didn't realize it, you have options of how to, kind of prevent this from happening the next year. You could use those same safe harbor methods I just talked about, meaning now make your estimated tax payments for 2022 based on your 2021 income and do quarterly estimated payments. So if at the end of 2021 you owed an additional $1,000 and you think the income and withholdings are going to be the exact same for 2022, well, then you could set yourself up to do quarterlies of $250 a quarter. Sometimes people don't want to bother with the quarterlies or they forget about them. You could do it all at once in the first quarter. Just pay it, boom, $1,000, be done with it. Or another option would be to increase your withholdings, whether it's on wages or a pension. Wages, you would go to your employer and fill out a new W-4 form. For a pension, you fill out a W-4P. For the government, Social Security, I think, what is it? Oh, I've just forgotten. W-4G, maybe? Don't remember. And there's only certain withholdings you can pick for Social Security, but you can request on any of those except for the Social Security one, because those are only flat amounts that you can elect, like 7, 10, 12, 22, I think. But for pensions and for wages, you can request additional amounts taken from each of your payments. All right, so I hope that helps, Marcy. Thank you for your question. Folks, it is listeners' questions tonight. So if you have any, you're welcome to call in. You can talk live on air with me, or if you're not comfortable talking live, give your question to Eric. The phone number is 610-758-8810. Back in a moment.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including fee-based asset management. It all starts with personal goals and an understanding of risk tolerance, investment objectives, and the markets. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
WDIY's public affairs interviews are now on major podcast platforms. This month's edition of the Jennings Report features Alan Jennings talking to U.S. Senator Bob Casey.
There are lots of platforms and venues where Putin is being praised in our country. You know that.
Oh, my gosh. Even unbelievable. By a former president.
Yeah. Goofy American politicians who should pay a political price for what they're doing.
Listen to the Jennings Report, available now on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices right here on WDIY 88.1, also available at wdiy.org. Following up on the withholding changes, Social Security, I quickly looked it up. It is a W-4V, V as in Victor, and the flat rates for that are 7, 10, and 12, and 22%. So people don't often realize you can have withholdings on Social Security, but you can. And quite often, I don't think the Social Security office will ask you about that. So you have to ask yourself or, you know, investigate it and do the form. But it's, you know, you can just Google it online and do it. W-4V for Social Security, W-4P for pension, and just the regular W-4 for your wages. So you can increase your withholdings to cover any shortfall in taxes. And in fact, even IRA distributions, quite often people will wait to do their required minimum distribution till the end of the year and then adjust their withholdings from their IRA distribution to cover their taxes for the year. I have had people, you know, take a IRA distribution if their required minimum distribution is $60,000 and they owe $60,000, they will just do 100% withholding on their IRA. You can request whatever percent you need on that. So keep that in mind. That's a good way to cover taxes because it's deemed to be paid evenly throughout the year when we do it through withholdings. Folks, if you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. And I'm just going to remind folks that if you do have questions, you can call in tonight, listeners' tax questions. Next week, I don't think we'll be doing questions. I think we start our pledge drive, our membership drive next week, so I won't probably be taking live calls. And then we'll move on to some other subjects in April. So if you have a question, it's a good idea to call tonight. Again, the phone number is 610-758-8810, and you can talk live on air with me or off air, whatever works for you. Now, a few other things that I wanted to talk about were beneficiaries of an estate. Now, this can be a little complicated, and you might not feel like you see it that often, but I think it's so maybe not misunderstood as much as just people not knowing that if you're the beneficiary of an estate, there are a number of ways that you could end up inheriting. We often use the words estate when we inherit something. We say, oh, I inherited from the estate. But that might not be the correct wording because you can inherit in any number of ways. So I think it's really important that if you find out someone has passed away and passed something on to you, whether you're related or not, you want to understand what you're inheriting and how you're inheriting it. Are you inheriting it as a joint owner? Are you inheriting it as a beneficiary? How are you inheriting these assets? So I'll talk more about that in just a minute, but I have a call on line one right now from Dave in Nazareth. Hi, Dave. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Okay.
Hi. How can I help you?
Question relates to the taxability of earned income on gift to minor accounts. And I'll give you a specific example of my son's father-in-law has accounts set up for our grandkids. He's the custodian, and they're set up as gift to minor accounts.
Yep.
And the, you know, this is the first year, apparently, that the dividends and capital gains on the oldest child exceeded, I think, like $4,000. And just trying to understand the taxability associated with that, whether he would be required to file a return for the child or the parents would be required. And I believe there's a Form 8615 also.
Yes.
Okay.
There's a kiddie tax. So what happens, Dave, is when people set up these custodial accounts, quite often as a grandparent makes a gift maybe to the grandchild, they set it up in the grandchild's name and social security number, but they retain the control of it until that child reaches the age of majority. A lot of times then the grandparents are the ones who are receiving the tax documents, and they have to remember to pull those out and give them to the child or the parents of the child if the child's not old enough to file the tax return themselves. So on these custodial accounts, or it's called UTMA or UGMA, Uniform Trust to Minors Act, or back in the day we called them the Uniform Gift to Minors Act, they will have income that has to get reported on a tax return. If it's below a certain threshold, they may not have any filing requirement for federal. For if they're Pennsylvania residents, it's like $35. I mean, it's crazy. $35 you have to file a tax return. Then for federal, if it's over certain thresholds, the child's going to have to file the tax return and possibly coordinate with the parents to do the kiddie tax calculation, because there are certain thresholds for the kiddie tax. Gosh, it says kiddie tax threshold is $2,200, and you're saying it's if the child had about $4,000 in gains, then they would file a return. Typically, it's best done when you have software, and if the parents use a CPA, they would want to give the tax document for the child to the CPA, and they can marry these tax returns together and do the calculation. Because what happens is if the kids are over a certain threshold, they may get taxed, the income may get taxed at the parents' rate.
Okay.
So it's complicated. It's a complicated calculation in my perspective, and that's using software. I mean, you enter the parents' whole tax return, you enter the child's investment income into the tax return, and then usually you have these two tax returns talk together, you calculate them, and it'll spew out what the tax consequence is for the child. And here's the thing, Dave, if there's more than one child, you have to kind of put them all together.
Depending
on the income. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So ordinarily, like if the parents are in a low tax bracket, it might not matter, especially if it's capital gains, because in the lowest tax brackets, capital gains are taxed at zero. But if you have parents who are in, you know, the higher tax bracket, 22% or something, then the capital gains could end up getting taxed at 15% on part of those earnings for the child. So, yes, there is going to be some calculations, and someone's going to have to do those.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah, apparently, from my discussion with him earlier, he did file a return on behalf of the older child who had the capital gains and dividends that exceeded the $2,200, and using the one of the softwares, one of the popular softwares, it calculated the tax, but it didn't complete. It didn't do matching against parents' income or his income. So I don't know how the IRS will react.
Well, if whoever entered it for the child entered the parents' numbers on the Form 8615, you know, the software might have done it. I just know the software we use, you just calc it, and they calc both returns at the same time. So it's really kind of nice. And so someone might have entered the numbers right if they, you know, had off-the-shelf software. Some of them are more sophisticated. I have not had to use one of the off-the-shelf softwares to do this particular calculation. But if it requested, if the software sometimes leads people through the questions and the answers, so if they entered the parents' information into that form, it still might work. Still might work.
All right.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't believe you did. I think you believe you just filed the return on behalf of the child.
Okay. Then it might show zero because they might. Maybe chat with him and see. And you know, you could always wait and see if the IRS, you know, sends a notice or something. But
yeah,
it's tricky. Yeah, back in the day, parents would often gift to their children or grandchildren to kind of for estate planning purposes, and then the IRS, Congress, whomever got on to that and said, wait, you're shifting what could be higher taxable income to these lower income tax brackets. We're not going to let you do that anymore. Same thing happened with trust. Trusts have very high tax rates very fast. Yeah. It's still, you know, there's still some bit of a deduction for the kids. So it's okay. It's just like my earlier call, lots of capital gains hit in 2021 at the end. So,
yeah.
Okay. All right. Good.
That was
good.
Very helpful.
Thank you, Dave. Go ahead.
One other quick question, Lori, can I ask you?
Yeah, sure.
This is the first year that I received from both the IRS and the state a form on interest associated with the tax refunds for year 2020.
Uh-huh.
I'm making the assumption that is taxable income to be reported on the 2021 return.
Yes. So if you overpaid 1 year and they sat on your refunds, because remember last year, the returns weren't required to be filed until like May, but technically they would have been due in April. And so if the IRS or PA took a while to give you the refund, they're required to pay you interest. And if the interest is over a certain amount, they're required to report it on a 1099. Typically it's over $10. Then you report it as interest income. Yep.
Okay, great.
Okay.
All right.
Take care.
You,
good
Lord.
Luck. Thank you for calling. Right. Thank you for talking. Have a good night.
Bye. Bye.
Folks, we are going to a break, and we will be back in just a moment.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including income tax preparation for individuals, businesses, estates, and trusts. Tax preparation involves more than putting numbers on a return. It requires planning. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Psst! Did you know your phone is a radio? You can tune into WDIY anywhere on the go with WDIY's phone app. Download for free from the Apple or Google Store, and your phone will become your trusted radio. The easy-to-use app lets you listen to WDIY on your phone live and access your favorite music shows on demand. Download and share the WDIY app with your friends and family and introduce them to many choices, real voices.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices right here on WDIY.org at 88.1. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. 8810, that's 610-758-8810, and email is also available at yourfinancialchoices.com. So thank you, Dave, for calling in with that question. I love questions, and you know, people sometimes need to hear that because they may not realize for your in your circumstance, for example, some people don't think about those UTMA or UGMA accounts, and they don't think about grandma and grandpa putting those together. And all of a sudden, one day, you're surprised because you get a tax document reported in your child's Social Security number. And grandparents, you know, sometimes have that mail coming to their house. So watch out for that. So the topic tonight is listeners' tax questions. So one thing that I have been talking about with a number of clients, actually, I've kind of made a consolidation of this question. Beneficiaries of an estate, to understand how you're inheriting, you want to know what you're inheriting and how you're inheriting it. Is it a joint account? Is it a transfer on death account? Is it an inherited account, like an inherited IRA or life insurance? Or are you a beneficiary of an estate or a beneficiary of a trust? They all have different reporting that you might be subject to. So, for example, a joint account, if you own a joint account with someone and they pass away and you're the joint owner with rights of survivorship, if the account really was theirs and they were the first person named on the account, then if it's spouses, it's not a big deal. But I'm talking about brother and sister, mother and daughter, that type of thing. If the primary owner on the account is in their Social Security number, typically you're going to report the income in their ID number. If it's, you know, really sometimes set up for estate planning, it's not really half your assets, but legally it might be. But usually the primary Social Security number on the account will report the income. Well, when they die, then it's income through their date of death. And then from their date of death forward, legally, that would be your account. And then you're responsible for reporting the income going forward. So we would have to do something called a split year, where you split the income reporting from the date of death forward on your own personal return. So you have to understand, when you inherit something, what are you inheriting it? How are you inheriting it? And how does it then get reported in that year? Transfer on death is similar to that joint. It also could include a split year, but the transfer on death wasn't yours during the decedent's lifetime. It wasn't jointly owned. They owned it, and then they report the income through their date of death, and then you pick it up. Sometimes joint accounts you do split, but the TOD is not splitting because you weren't a joint owner during lifetime. You're just a transfer on death. And quite often we might see that where someone might name transfer on death to maybe, you know, three kids or five nieces and nephews. It could be anything for transfer on death. It could even be to a charity. Inherited accounts would be like inherited IRAs, inherited Roth IRAs. Typically, what you have to make sure you understand there is that if you these aren't like other IRAs. These are not like Roth IRAs where you just roll it over to your own. No. It completely changes the tax implications. If you take money out of an inherited IRA thinking you're going to put it into your own, it's a completely a taxable event and you have no other options. In these kinds of cases with inherited retirement accounts, you typically want to do it. Well, you do want to do a trustee to trustee transfer. The only time I would say someone would want to take it out is if we're talking about really small amounts. I like doing the trustee to trustee transfer first, because then you can explore your options later depending on your tax situation. So trustee to trustee transfer, very important to know what you're inheriting and how you're inheriting and what you're inheriting, because you have to be careful. So trustee to trustee transfers on any inherited retirement accounts. Then you always have to check, did the decedent have a required minimum distribution that they did not take before they died? If they did, you as the beneficiary have to take that out. They have to meet the required minimum distribution before year end, but then that becomes yours. So make sure you understand how that works, and then you will have required minimum distributions based on, you know, the law at the time. And now the law is, if you inherit a retirement account now, other than certain designated beneficiaries, and I won't get into that, basically you have 10 years to take out an IRA or a Roth IRA, but you have a 10-year window for the most part. Spouses have completely different rules, minors and disability and things like that. Designated beneficiaries have different options. And then there is always inheriting from an estate or from a trust. And that has different implications as well, which I will get into. One thing I had mentioned, too, is life insurance. Life insurance is not income taxable to people when they inherit from a life insurance policy. But quite often we will see interest income on the policy value, on the death benefit. We will see interest income quite often. So you might get a 1099 for interest income on inheriting a life insurance policy, but the life insurance itself is not income taxable. Folks, we are at the halfway point. If you have questions, listeners, tax questions, that's the topic. The phone number is 610-758-8810. We'll be back in just a moment.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including estate planning and tax preparation, especially for Pennsylvania and New Jersey residents subject to state inheritance tax reporting. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
WDIY Allentown, the time is now 6:30, and your current temperature is 44 with cloudy skies. Lehigh Valley weather tonight is going to be low around 42, and for your Thursday, it's going to be high 53 and sunny. Thursday night, we're going to have some showers, low 43 degrees. And for your Friday, it's going to be sunny, high 57. Friday night, low around 40 degrees. And for your Saturday, it's going to be partly sunny, 53. Saturday night, low 34. Now back to your financial choices with Lori Siebert.
Thank you, Shandi. Folks, if you have questions, you can talk live on air with me, or if you're not comfortable talking live on air, give your question to Eric. He's in the studio waiting for your calls. The phone number is 610-758-8810. We are talking about listeners' tax questions. In particular, I was talking about some of the issues we run into when people inherit. There's a lot of confusion around that. And I hate to say it, but sometimes I think there's even some confusion with attorneys. I recently had a case where someone told me they were the executor of an estate. I was reporting the executor fee as income. They also inherited from the estate. And I said, well, were there assets? Yes, there were assets. Are you getting a K-1 from the estate? And she said, no, the attorney's office said, no, there's no K-1. There's nothing to report. She gave me a copy of the inheritance tax return, and I looked at it, and I'm seeing like $50,000 of, executor commissions and legal fees, and I'm seeing lots of assets, and I couldn't quite understand why there wouldn't be any reporting. And the executor didn't sign a tax return or anything for the estate. And I said, you really need to go back to the attorney and ask about this. And so they did. And then the attorney said, well, there's no deductions because, people take standard deduction now. There's no more deductions for estate excess deductions. Well, that rule changed, and the IRS actually had clarified it with some, regulations. And back in 2020, clarifying that if there are excess deductions on an estate, meaning the deductions that an estate is allowed to deduct on the income tax return for that estate, if those deductions exceed the income in the estate, then $1,000 of income less $50,000 of expenses is $49,000 excess deduction, right? That can pass through to the beneficiaries, the residuary beneficiaries of the estate. In this case, the estate, this isn't like inheriting an IRA or the life insurance policy. This is actual estate beneficiaries through the will. And you can claim an excess deduction, and what it used to be a miscellaneous itemized deduction, and miscellaneous itemized deductions went away. So the thought was, oh, darn, excess deductions are gone. We don't get to take them anymore. But the IRS came back and clarified the rules and said, yes, they allow certain of excess deductions. They're called Section 67E deductions, which include usually the largest deductions we see in an estate, which are typically the legal fees and the executor fees, sometimes like the probate fees and income tax deduction or income tax preparation, accounting fees, things like that. Those are 67E deductions that the IRS tells us that we can take. They're reported on the K-1 from the estate income tax return after the estate, you know, figures out all the income, less all the deductions. If there are any excess deductions, it gets reported on the K-1 and the individuals get to report it on their tax return as a deduction against income on Schedule 1 of the tax return on line 24. So, that's something to keep in mind if you're inheriting from an estate, if there's going to be excess deductions. Typically, we would see those when usually if you've used a lawyer or had an executor who takes a commission. Quite often, those fees can be high. Now, in this particular circumstance, what we found out is the estate had annuities, and annuities have what we call income in respect of a decedent. That income always stays taxable, whether it was to the decedent before they died or after they died, income in respect of a decedent. So there was quite large taxable income that then was offset by those, you know, deductions. So it was almost a wash, but not quite. There were still some excess deductions. So the estate was still required to file a tax return because if an estate has gross income over $600, they're required to file an estate income tax return. So irregardless of, you know, whether there would be tax or excess deductions to beneficiaries, there was a requirement for the executor to file an estate income tax return to report this taxable income. And what else was on the annuity 1099 reflecting the whatever $30,000 of income? I'm making this up. There was also $3,000 of federal withholding that came through on that annuity that was withheld in the estate's ID number. The only way to get that withholding back is to file the tax return to let the IRS know, here was the income, here are the deductions, we have no taxable income left, but we do have a $3,000 refund to us from this withholding that was on the 1099. So, you know, we're talking about income tax tonight and questions, but at some point in your life, you may end up being a beneficiary of an estate. You may be doing your own estate planning, and you want to think through what kind of assets you have, what kind of titling do you have, how are you passing these assets to beneficiaries, because it can make a big difference on the tax returns. The other thing that happens is when you're inheriting, I already talked a little bit about joint accounts, transfer on death accounts, inherited accounts, retirement accounts. Remember, trustee transfer, that's the first thing you think. And you might also inherit just, you know, assets that mom and dad might have had, like individual stocks. Sometimes people think you have to sell out of everything and distribute cash. And that's not usually the case. Quite often we'll see attorneys draft the will, the documents, to say that the executor has the management discretion to distribute in cash or in kind. And what it means to distribute in kind is the executor or trustee, could be in a trust, has the right to distribute the assets. They don't have to distribute the cash. I just was talking with an executor earlier before I came in tonight, and the estate that he was working on has been held up for several years because they were still trying to sell a piece of land. And there were also some investments. And he said every time he goes to, you know, sell the investments, and we don't manage them, so I couldn't advise him on that. But he said every time we go to sell the investments, there's a fluctuation in the market, and so then I don't. And I said to him, you know, I don't think he was working with an attorney. He's in another state, this gentleman. And I just help him with the taxes a bit. And I said, you know, you could distribute in kind. You don't have to distribute. You don't have to sell the assets. You can distribute the assets in kind to the beneficiaries. And then it's not his responsibility to worry about, you know, the volatility. You know, executors do have a prudent investor rule kind of, you know, fiduciary duty they have to follow. Of course, they can't go into just anything, but you know, good solid investments still are subject to fluctuations in the market, but you can distribute in kind. So when someone's inheriting, then again, back to the question of what happens when you inherit, you also want to say, what is the cost basis? Because typically certain trusts don't have it. It depends on what kind of trust. If you're inheriting from a trust, some trusts, you know, do get a step up in basis at the death of the, you know, grantor. But sometimes these are trusts that have gone from, you know, generation to generation, have different kinds. But let's say it's an estate. Definitely a step up in basis. Trust that someone controls when they die, complete control, could get a step up in basis. The step up in basis says if the assets, if mom bought these assets, you know, so long ago, and they paid, you know, $2,000 for their, you know, Apple stock, and it's worth, you know, $100,000 now, and they die, then the cost basis is now $100,000, not the $2,000 that they bought it for. So when you inherit assets, you also want to make sure you know what the date of death value was, that if you decide to take the shares in kind as your inheritance, that you have the proper cost basis on those assets and the holding period, because it becomes long-term automatically. So someone might have bought, you know, some great stock 11 months ago and then they die. It gets a step up in basis and it's not short-term. It's not that holding period. The date of death is sets the value, and the holding period is automatically long-term. So for tax purposes, you want to make sure that you understand all of that. I have had estates where we have highly, highly, highly appreciated land, and the family inherited it from dad, you know, probably 50 years ago, and they don't know what the cost basis was back then. It might have been even more than 50 years ago. They don't know what the cost basis was. And we, you know, kind of hard to figure out at this point, apparently. And so the IRS assumes the cost basis is zero if you don't know what it is. All right. So you want to make sure that you have that figured out. Okay. We had a call come in from Easton, Gabriel. Any benefit to each claiming one dependent, not married, or should she claim both equal salaries? Well, Gabrielle, that is a good question, and it kind of depends, especially this year in particular, 2021. It's a little crazy with tax returns with children, and that's because we had possibly advanced child credits. I don't know if your kids are young enough that you got an advanced child credit. And the typical child tax credit is $2,000. If your kids, I think, were under, golly, I don't remember the age, maybe six, it was $3,600. And if they were over six, it's $3,000 or something like that. Anyway, and then the IRS started issuing advance credits in July to the tune of half that people could get. So what happens when you go to file your tax return, Gabrielle, if you're claiming the kids who got the advance child credit and who got the stimulus payments for your children, because those were paid based on 2020 numbers, not 2021. And for married people, at least, the credits were deemed to be half to each parent, the advance credits and the stimulus payments, half to each parent, depending on how, you know, who filed in 2020. So then what happens in 2021, it's like almost a whole new ball game. And it's almost too complicated to explain on the show. I would suggest you go see a tax preparer. The best way to know what is best to claim would to be run the numbers. So, for example, Gabrielle, if you claimed both the children in 2020 and in 2021, you could both be, you have a partner, you're not married, but you live in the same house and you could both claim the children, then you might have some options to have, you know, one of you claim or one of you claim both. Maybe the other than what happened in 2020. So I'm not going to give any advice as to that. I'm just going to tell you that is something that you really need to explore, probably with a tax preparer, as to which would be best, and run the numbers and look at and see how they come out. But they will need to know who got the stimulus payments and the child credits for the children, as well as for yourselves, but as for the children in particular. All right? Complicated. I'm lucky I have software that figures these things out for me. I just have to know how to put it in. So good, very, very good question, Gabrielle, and something that definitely needs to be explored. Folks, the phone number is 610-758-8810. We'll be back in just a moment.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services including portfolio management, tax return preparation, and financial planning for the accumulation years, retirement years, and estate distribution. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
American folk music offers a variegated pattern of performers and styles. I'm Tom Druckenmiller, your host for In the Tradition. Together, we'll trace the roots and branches of American folk music from the earliest recordings and performers through today's talented players. In the Tradition, Wednesday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. on WDIY 88.1 FM and WDIY.org.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices right here on WDIY. Phone number is 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. And we are taking listeners' tax questions. So I want to point out just a couple other things that have come up that people might not realize. And that is the difference between federal treatment and state treatment of income. Recall that for federal purposes, we get a deduction if we're making contributions to a 401k on a pre-tax basis. In states like Pennsylvania, we don't get that deduction. So you want to make sure that you're reviewing the W-2 when you get it to make sure you understand all those numbers on the W-2. For federal purposes, you can take a deduction for a health savings account if you have a high deductible health plan that qualifies and you have a health savings account. Typically, we're doing those contributions to health savings accounts through our payroll, and it shows up on our W-2 as a code W in box 12. But if you did not make a full contribution to your health savings account, you certainly can still make that up by April 15th for the previous year. So you have to, this year it's April 18th, that you can still do that for 2021. And that could be a deduction for Pennsylvania as well. So that is kind of the same treatment for federal and state, but it's better to do it through payroll deduction. U.S. Treasury interest, I wanted to point that out, is different. So for federal purposes, we do pay income tax on U.S. Obligations like savings bonds or, you know, Treasury bills, things like that, treasury investments, government money markets, that type of thing. We pay tax for the federal to the federal government on that income. But for Pennsylvania purposes, any state excludes U.S. obligations. So when we have invested in U.S. obligations, it's not going to be taxable at the state level. It's very easy to see when we have, for example, savings bond interest and we cash them in the bank and the bank gives us a 1099 and it shows the box number, you know, box one is taxable interest and box, I don't know what it is, 1B, 1A, I'm not sure, but it'll tell you it's savings bond interest, U.S. savings bond interest. It would get excluded automatically if you're using software for, if you're doing it by hand, you'd have to know to exclude it, so it's not taxable for state purposes. But what many people might miss is in mutual funds. If you invest in mutual funds, that you might have a number of mutual funds that could have some U.S. obligation exposure. And that's typically when you might get the little statement in your 1099 packet showing the percentage that your mutual fund invested in U.S. obligations, but sometimes it's not on there. So you kind of have to know the name of the funds you have. Like if you have a, you know, short-term U.S. Treasury or something like that in the name of the fund you're using, it might be worthwhile Googling that fund, Google that ticker, and look for the tax information to exclude it. If you only have like 10 bucks, totally not worth it. If you have 200 bucks, it might not even be worth it. But if you have sizable mutual funds that, you know, if you're a conservative investor and in your taxable accounts and you have big, you know, kind of exposure to government mutual funds, then it might be worth doing the calculations to exclude that income for tax purposes at the state level. And one way to really kind of see that is when I look at dividends on someone's statement and I see if their dividends are $10,000 and their qualified dividends are $3,000, that tells me they have a lot of probably fixed income exposure. And the fixed income exposure could be corporate bonds, but it could also be U.S. Treasury type of investment. So that's a good way to kind of eyeball it to see if you need to go through those calculations. If your qualified dividends are practically as high as your ordinary dividends, then, you know, there's usually it's more equity exposure than U.S. government exposure. Okay. Another item that I see often on tax returns, and this is typically for higher net worth folks, people who maybe are in their highest earning years and then they retire. When you hit age 65 and you go on Medicare, if you have retired and now you're going on Medicare Part B, your Medicare premiums are based on your income from like a couple years before. So you really want to monitor your income to see if it comes under the thresholds for those increased premiums. It's called the income-related monthly adjustment amount, the IRMA adjustment. If your income, married, filing, joint, I think it's like $182,000 now. I'm going off the top of my head. If it goes over certain thresholds, then the premiums increase. And there's a special form you can complete to lower that, to let Social Security know that you've had a change in your life, a life event. It can be a work reduction and it could be a work stoppage. So I have had where people have scaled back. Typically, this is doctors or lawyers or people who have more consulting kind of roles or people who want to retire and their employer says, no, no, please stay part-time, whatever. So their wages can take quite a dip when they go from working full-time, you know, long career to part-time or, you know, work reduction and or work stoppage. You can fill out a form SSA-44 to let Medicare, Social Security Medicare, let them know that your income is going to go down and then they can lower your Medicare premiums to the threshold based on the income that you expect. I mean, this has saved some of my clients thousands of dollars. Thousands. Those Medicare premiums can go up high fairly quickly. The bands, the tiers for those thresholds are very narrow. They narrowed them a few years ago and they're very narrow and your Medicare premium can jump very quickly. You usually get that statement in December and then January it starts happening. Many people don't even look at those. They just, oh, you know, just oh, something from Medicare telling me my new Social Security amount. And they're not paying attention necessarily to how much the Social Security is telling them the Medicare premiums are going to be, you can fill out that SSA 44 form, you know, at any time. You can do it now if you see it and you're hearing about this for the first time. If you do do it, I'd love to hear your story. I love when we make a difference in, you know, stories that we're sharing here. Another reminder about the qualified charitable distribution. I am going to talk about charitable giving next week and all the different ways that you can do that. But just a reminder, when you get your 1099-R on your tax return, and again, the only people who can do qualified charitable distributions from IRAs are people who are 70 and a half or older. Even though the required minimum distribution age is now 72, you can use your IRA to do a qualified charitable distribution, but you have to be 70 and a half. But your 1099-R is not going to tell anybody that. You have to know it. The 1099-R is not going to say you did a QCD. Your tax preparer will not know this unless you tell them. You will not remember it unless you've written it down. So if you did it in January of 2021, and then you get your tax document in January or February of 2022, you might have forgotten you even did it. So that is where you do a distribution from your IRA directly to charity. So you have the custodian of the IRA write a check directly to that nonprofit 501c3. You have to literally adjust the taxable amount in your software or with your pencil on your tax return if you're doing that, or in a note to your accountant or tax preparer that of this amount I took out, this much is a QCD. So I will give you an example. If I have someone who does, you know, has a required minimum distribution of $16,000 and they say, I don't need it, I don't want it, you can do the whole thing to charity. Their tax document's going to come in, distribution $16,000, taxable $16,000. They've told me that they did it to charity. They have a receipt for that. I tell the software, zero taxable, $16,000 QCD. A code shows up on page one of the tax return saying QCD. We know that's what that was. If their required minimum distribution $16,000 and they do $4,000 QCD, then I have taxable amount of $12,000. 4,000 QCD, we still have a code for QCD. If there's withholdings on the IRA, that's a quick way for me to check to see if it makes sense. If someone had a $10,000 distribution from their IRA and they had, $1,000 withholding on their IRA and they're in the top tax bracket, I might be suspicious. Why would they have only had $1,000, $10,000 out of that? Hey, did you do a QCD out of there? Yeah, Lori, I did a $5,000 QCD. I had 20% withheld on my IRA, $1,000 on $5,000. And that's another way to tell, you know, if someone's done one. So watch out for that, the QCD. Here's something else that's come up for a number of people that have asked, you know, mom died in 2021. Mom hadn't filed returns for years. She had, she died in January of 2021. I'm making this up. And does she have to file her 2021 tax return? Well, we're now in March of 2022. Social Security was alerted she passed away in January of 2021. The IRS was probably notified that she passed away because, you know, Social Security notifies everybody and that usually gets, you know, registered somewhere. But what might have happened? What happened in 2021? In March, mid-March of 2021, if you qualified, if you were alive, January 1 of 2021, and your income was within certain thresholds, you would qualify for a stimulus payment of $1,400. Well, if you weren't alive on March 15th because the IRS knew you weren't alive and they didn't pay you the $1,400, but you were alive January 1st, you just didn't file a tax return, guess what? you can file a tax return for the deceased person if they didn't get the $1,400 and claim the $1,400 under the recovery rebate credit. That's what we call the third round of the economic stimulus payment. It is a recovery rebate credit on our 2021 tax return. If you didn't otherwise get it based on your 2019 or 2020 tax return, if you were not entitled to it prior, but your 2021 income allows you to be, you can file a 2021 tax return to qualify for the recovery rebate credit, and that applies to people who were living. And I've actually had this happen to at least two people. They both, you know, different cases, passed away in January, and the personal representative filed the 2021 tax return for the recovery rebate credit of $1,400. It's their job. It's a fiduciary responsibility, and he will pass that out to the beneficiaries of the estate in that circumstance. In the other circumstance, there was no executor, no estate, so a child can file the form 1310, I think, to apply for that refund and swear that they will distribute it accordingly, you know, according to law. If there was no estate, it would go to the, you know, children of that decedent. All right. Well, thank you so much, listeners, for calling in tonight. I really appreciate it. I appreciate the questions and for sending the questions in through the website at Your Financial Choices as well. And next week, I am going to talk about charitable giving and all the different ways that folks can think about that, because you got to get creative. And I know I've talked about it on prior shows, but it's always worth mentioning again, especially during all of these challenging times. If you have questions, you can always send those through the website at yourfinancialchoices.com. Thank you, Eric, for being here. Thank you, Shandi. Thank you, listeners. Coming up next, we have Tom Druckenmiller with In the Tradition Folk Music. Remember, pay attention, be proactive, not reactive. Make the best of your financial choices, and have a great week.